Hi, how you doing? Congratulations. You've tuned in to Bob and Nick's Talk Hypnosis podcast. Thanks. You crazy cats are in for a treat. Wow.
I've always been fascinated by, hypnosis. I always see how that helps out people in their real life, but it's kind of scary for me. I've never had it done before, but what I'm going to do is try to learn a lot more about it by listening to a fantastic podcast with two good friends of mine, Bob Burns and his grandson, Nick, a podcast called Talk Hypnosis Podcast. But I got to warn you, some of the language may not be intended for children under the age of 15. I mean, the show is for mind nerds, neuro geeks, sophisticated therapists, and hypnosis trainers. It's educational. That's what I love about it. But it's also entertaining, too. So if you do happen to get offended by any of the language or references made, come on, lighten up, okay? And try your very best to enjoy the show. So without any more further ado, I'm going to hand you over to the two wise guys themselves, Bob and Nick. Fellas, take it away.
Hey, Christopher Walken, Andy Garcia. Who'd have thought they'd be on our show, Nick, eh?
They love it.
They're having the time of their lives. Anyway, it's week three. Let's talk very quickly, first of all. Hello, everybody. How are you? So I hope some of you listened in to our boy Felix Economakis. How was that, Nick? You like him?
Yeah, what a great one to start the interviews off with.
Mm-hmm. We've got a better one, better looking anyway, for sure, mm-hmm. later on in the show. We're going to have Lorraine Gleason on this week's show. It's going to be great. So, first of all, where are we? What are we talking about right now?
Well, Bob, we're gonna do something that you don't want to do. You don't want to do, but you tend to bring up a lot for something you don't want to do. We're going to have a little clear the air discussion about evidence-based hypnosis. Evidence-based hypnotists, and defining what that is from our perspective, from your perspective.
Yeah,
we'll have a little chat. We're not gonna go too much into it.
Yeah,
I think it's about time, because I think it's one of those topics, right, Bob, that's just going to come up again and again and again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's make it a wee discussion, and if I can tweak it a little bit and kind of slant myself to one side, so that people against that thought can come back. Write in, tell us what they think, and I know that we're going to get a couple of good guests later on,
yeah,
who will want to completely destroy my thoughts, and that's great. I'm very, very happy for that. So let me just tweak from a certain side. We're going to take sides here, aren't we? Ever so slightly.
Yeah.
Yeah? So my side will be, so we've got evidence-based, and we've got, what's the name of that other one I can never remember?
Anecdotal.
Everyone, it's a big word. It's a big one. So I tend to fall towards the anecdotal side. You've been better educated than me. You fall towards the evidence-based side. People would never know it by your tongue. But there you go. You look cleverer than you look. So where are we? What's the first questions with us? What are we asking ourselves?
Well, basically, let's just have a very little brief bit of background. For those who listened to the very first show, one of our motivations for doing this show were the arguments, the discussions that turned into arguments, or the deliberate arguments that were filling the social media forums and platforms. And some of the better arguments were on the pages and the groups that had a bias towards the scientific evidence behind hypnosis. Okay, I think that's fair to say. And you, Bob, mm-hmm. were very happy to stick your head above the water on a number of occasions and challenge the, for want of a better word, the point of some of the evidence that was being used, and questioned where it actually fitted in with being a professional hypnotherapist.
Yeah. And we want people, I mean, we can say this now, because people will forget this, which is absolutely great, that just because I argue a certain case might not mean that that's what I think. I might be tweaking it a little bit so that somebody can give me an argument against it. But across the board, on the whole, in general, yeah, it is probably very much what I think. So let's see where we are with this one here. Shall I kick off?
Go for it.
So basically, evidence-based is always, I mean, we've got two things, haven't we, as far as hypnosis goes. We've got this evidence-based group, and we have the anecdotal group. Here's my first problem, Nick. The anecdotal group aren't interested in even having this discussion, really. They've never, a lot of them have never heard of evidence-based. They're not interested in evidence-based. I'm on about the good guys here, right? Mm-hmm. I'm on about the good guys. The good guys do the work. They honestly say what they've got. They share it with their peers. The peers try it. It repeats. They come back. And they have some form of evidence, which they would consider to be evidence-based. Not proof-based, but evidence-based. But we're talking about a different thing here, aren't we? It's words, and words have different meanings. On the other hand, is the evidence-based, well, it will always be initially based on a hypothesis, will it not? A single statement, i.e. this is a fact, yeah? Or we think this works like so-and-so. So anecdotal evidence, as we've said, is mainly peer review or repeatability. But it's not enough to define as what we call scientific research, yeah? Mm-hmm. So no matter what I do is anecdotal. If I send my thing out to 1,000 people there, they'll try it and they'll come back and say, this is absolutely fantastic and it works. Nothing works all the time, but it works 99.2%, whatever. You would think that would be evidence-based, but it's not. It's not allowed to be evidence-based because, you know, it hasn't had that scientific research. It hasn't been accepted for publication by Nature or BNA or Psychology Today or The Philosopher. And I'm asking, is that okay? Is that absolutely fair? Is that absolutely the way it should be, where someone has to say, I read it in Edmondson and Itchback in a paper they did on healing the cognitive in June 1994. Is that evidence-based or is that not a form of anecdotal? Because it might not be right. Just because they did the paper might not be correct. Although the argument is, but it must be because it was accepted through scientific research, accepted for publication by Nature, BNA, Psychology Today, blah, 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 and round and round it goes, yeah? Mm-hmm. And my main argument, Nick, is what good is it to me, the working therapist? Remember, we're talking about the good guys right now. We know there's the bad guys. We know there's the anecdotal guys who make claims that everybody comes to see me, I fix them in 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and I do it by wiggling the fingers of my left hand while I pull on their ear. It's an incredible thing. It goes to the conglia, and the conglia loves it. But we know all of this stuff is nonsense. We know there's the bad guys. I'm talking about the good guys who do their work, and they are happy to share it with their peers. Is there room there for science to step into their therapy room? In other words, could an evidence-based person, hypnotherapist, walk into my therapy room and help me with a case that's about to start in 60 seconds? What would they give me that I could use for my 12 o'clock case today?
Okay, I think in answer to that question, and I'm going to answer some of those points in no particular order. Just to clarify, there are some points that I do agree with Bob on, but for the sake of argument and debate, I want to counter the points that he's made. The first one is this. You're making a question, and in that question you're actually implying an assumption as well, which is an evidence-based hypnotist doesn't have practical experience using what he has gleaned from scientific research and putting it into practice. Now, what I would suggest is that there are a number of people, both trainers and hypnotherapists, who do have a leaning and a bias towards the scientific evidence-based approaches, but are actually active practitioners as well, and active change workers, and dare I say, some actually really bloody good ones as well at that. So I think it's they're not purely theoretical. So that's looking at it from the point of the evidence-based therapists. Because that they are still therapists. They also aren't immune to embracing certain protocols and processes that they'll admit that there isn't enough extensive or conclusive research on as well. I think the idea of what the value of evidence base is actually a broader thing. And with that in mind, the second point that I'd like to respond to, and you touched on it, is the anecdotal guys. Now, as you know, I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about these anecdotal guys, because there are anecdotal guys and there are not so anecdotal guys. And you touched on it earlier, the anecdotal guys who say this works, and I'll show you this works, and they demonstrate it in a classroom setting with a very captive audience and with a very malleable subject. Some, dare I say, that they already know is a malleable subject. And they will actually pass that off as anecdotal or practical evidence that their process, their system works. Now, what I would say is that they're probably they're where the focus should really lie on what's right or what's wrong in terms of therapy, in terms of training. I think you're talking from your own point of view, your own perspective subjectively, that you see clients on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis over many years, and you know that the processes that you use, that you incorporate, won't have any research to substantiate them, but you're 100% comfortable that they work. But unfortunately, you're one of the good guys. But in being one of the good guys, you've inadvertently scooped up all of the fake anecdotalists as well. And I think the problem is, not even shouldn't be about focusing on evidence base, because, as I'll go on to later, I think there is a value to that. The real problem should be distinguishing between the genuine therapist using processes that don't have any scientific validity. And that might be just because people haven't, you know, it's a money thing as well, right? There's not enough motivation to look into every single process, every single protocol that's out there. It doesn't mean that they're throwing it out. But the problem is, the anecdotalists who are selling stuff as anecdotal, and it's not. It's just a demonstration of a process in a very contrived setting. And just very quickly, because I've been waffling already, my value for evidence base or having a foundation of evidence base is to show not the experienced therapist, but the potential new hypnotist, the new trainee, that you have put in a certain amount of effort, time, money, research, commitment to exploring not just the phenomena, but what lies beneath the phenomena of hypnosis. And I think that is one way, positively, that a lot of evidence-based trainers and therapists distinguish themselves from the potential charlatans that are passing themselves off as anecdotalists.
Well, that's what lies beneath the phenomena is, it's a question I love, and we're not going to get involved in that now. It'll have to be for another day. Mm-hmm. But if we go back to the first part of what you said, Nick, when you said that, you know, that I was making an assumption, as you were doing that, I was smiling, thinking, isn't it interesting how Nick's assuming that I was making an assumption? but I get what you're saying, because if you make an assumption, and the assumption is wrong, then you have false premise, and if you have false premise, it's all a waste of time. Everything you say now. So I get what you're saying, and you also said that you know of evidence-based guys who are very practical in the therapy room, and there you go. That's the first time that either of us have used that word. If we dump evidence-based and we dump anecdotal, and we end up with the word practical, then we've cracked it, have we not?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's practical and it works, then that's it. We'll never have to use this conversation ever, ever again. You can have the wildest anecdotal guy who's completely crazy, but if he's practical and it works, then we just have to give him plaudits. And the same vice versa with the evidence-based guys. But when we come back, and I couldn't argue with what you said about malleable subjects. I mean, malleable subjects is such a pain, isn't it? I'm not going to mention any names. I'm not going to even get close to giving a clue. But I've mentioned to you, and you know that I met a guy who's actually a brilliant hypnotist who runs workshops. And he actually told me a couple of years ago he would never dream of having a workshop if he didn't have six pure somnambulists sitting in the front seat before he starts his... And in a way, I get him, by the way. I'm not knocking that, because he has to show it working. And it's not just to show how good he is, although there'll be something in that as well. They have to see how it works before they can see what to do when it doesn't work. Whereas I'm not a lover, but I'm quite happy, as you know, to go in there and to fall on my arse so that somebody thinks, ha, what's he going to do now? So I get to show them what I do when it fails. And I've already said, with me, you know, it can fail a lot of the time, depending on the day, if it's a good day or a bad day. But I get what you're saying. In malleable subjects, showing a process isn't really what it's all about. But strangers walking through the door showing a process is great. That's why my big thing, as you know, mm-hmm. and I do go on about it, and I'm going to continue going on about it. But mentoring in the therapy room is just the coolest thing. It's how this whole thing really works for me. I want to throw in a couple of things just into the works there as well, because we're talking right now about having the knowledge, the know-how, the activity knowledge and the know-how. But, you know, it is an argument, and I think it's a good argument, that the practical therapists with no evidence base behind them at all, a lot of these people, these guys and girls, are artists. I think that the practicalities is a complete and absolute art form. There's no doubt about it. How they hesitate, how they modulate, how they emphasize, how they smile, how they touch, how they joke, how they stroke, how they don't stroke, how they know when to stroke and not to stroke. All of these things is just a complete and absolute art form. And again, back to the evidence-based stuff, if Edmondson and Itzbach did write that paper, Healing the Cognitive, in June 1994, I've got this thought in my head right now, everyone's going to be searching for this all over the internet, but if they did write such a paper, who did they write it about? Was it about Tom, or was it about Tom and Dick? And did it cover Harriet when she walked through the door? You know, does it cover everybody? Is there any evidence-based stuff that says this works for everybody in a therapy room? I'm quite happy for evidence-based to say this is how the brain works. I don't have a problem with that, but I'm not sure how that helps me as a practicing therapist in a room with the client that's about to come through the door and I don't know who they are. I think that's what I'm saying. I think the biggest thing is the evidence-based for me isn't quite so much about saying, here's the evidence-based work. But a lot of it I have noticed over the last 4 or 5 years is about knocking the anecdotal. Yeah. Hmm. And in all fairness to them, they're not knocking the anecdotal. They're knocking the bad anecdotal guys, guys who are saying this is what we use. But by doing that, they've got this brush with tar on it and they're slapping it about a bit too much. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they're kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to practical and anecdotal therapists as a whole.
Yeah.
I think one of the other things to bear in mind as well is that a lot of hypnotherapists, and I do so myself, is I get what you're saying about, and I have the same reservations about evidence and scientific research, because you know that I'm very big on intent and authenticity when it comes to a therapist. I think that really does make the difference. As you know, I was lucky enough to spend yesterday morning with someone like Freddie Jacquin, who is, you know, whereas Anthony is the scholar of the two. I think it would be very hard to argue that Freddie Jacquin is an absolute master of intent.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch him work and to watch him work with a level of conviction that most practical therapists just wouldn't have, you really do understand that there is more than just knowledge, that there is that ability to create that energy and that chemistry between you and that subject that I think must surely get missed in a research setting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but that in mind, going back to what I was going to say, the average hypnotherapist, good or bad, will incorporate a degree of self-hypnosis in the work that they're doing with their clients. And I think this is probably where evidence-based does come into its own, because although it may be hard to recreate certain and tick certain boxes when it comes to the one-on-one hypnosis session, when it comes to self-hypnosis, I think that's an easier thing to measure. I think if you do your research, there's countless amounts of research papers that prove that self-hypnosis has been has been proven to be effective in dealing with A, B, C, D, E, F, G issues, numerous issues. That's a great tool for a hypnotherapist to sell to a client to motivate them into incorporating self-hypnosis as part of their healing process. An anecdotalist has got, take my word for it, it works on the stuff that it does outside the therapy room. And I'm being a bit glib with that, and I could tell.
But by the way, that's a great line. Take my word for it, it works.
Yeah.
It takes a special art to be able to use that in the therapy room as well, yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But you know, I think, you know, with self-hypnosis and what have you. And you know what? Just going on, just made me think about something else as well. You know, yeah, I actually strongly believe that the evidence base behind the self-hypnosis, which we should be encouraging clients to work, is there. And it's a very useful thing. But here's the thing that I find about some of the, and again, we're probably touching on the more dismissive of the anecdotalists, is that they'll poo-poo evidence-based hypnotherapists, but at the first opportunity, use research to poo-poo other therapies.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, yeah,
I find that comical. The fact that, you know, that they promote that it's all about the practical, and then at the first opportunity, a report might come out about CBT or EMDR, or whatever, and all of a sudden, that research is valid.
Well, there's a whole trickling down thing about it as well, isn't there? Somebody called Jimmy tells me something, but Jimmy read it on the internet, and the person who put that up was Deborah, and Deborah read something on a clip that's 18 years old, and that came from Freddie. Now, Freddie, of course, et cetera, et cetera, yeah? So you wonder what you're actually getting right in front of you. Mm. Come back to that word you said earlier as well, Nick. You said intention. What do you mean by intention, and what's the value of it?
What I mean by intention is the practitioner, the hypnotist, the therapist, when he gives a suggestion, when he gives an instruction, it comes from a place of authenticity. In other words, he believes it. When he's delivering that line, that instruction, that suggestion, he believes it. He also believes that if the subject believes it, then that change can take place. We all know, whether it's evidence-based or anecdotal practitioners, we all know that we experience miracles. All right, that's a bit of a strong word, but let's just change that to amazing phenomena. Okay, we know that. Now, someone with a lot of intent will believe that that phenomena is a lot easier to manifest without any of the contrived situations or settings than someone who doesn't. And you know, going back to a Freddie, I've seen you at work, I've seen a number of people at work, and a lot of times the difference is that level of intent. Yeah. Self-belief, belief in the process, and the belief in the fact that if that person accepts and expects that suggestion to happen, it will happen as intended.
Yeah, but here's the crazy thing as well. If you go back to what you said, if you play this back, you'd have said something like, I'm paraphrasing, but something like, the thing about intention is, if someone intends, it's coming from the right area, it's with the right meaning, and they intend something to work, and they sell the person on that so that they believe that's going to happen, it can in fact happen. And what you said with all of that, the only word that had real value was the word can. Yeah? And what do I mean by that? Well, I mean this. If I use no intention at all, if I say to them, I'll tell you what, you can have a go at this, but I'm quite negative in the therapy room. And as you know, Nick, I actually do that. Yeah, have a go, see what happens, try it now, where's your pain now? So with no intention, just for a bit of fun, just to see what happens, that pain can go. But I know what's happening here anyway. I've already built up a belief system within them that this guy wouldn't tell me that unless he believed it was going to, so it's kind of a double bind, if you like. Yeah. So,
absolutely.
But the thing that concerns me about the intention, the word intention, is I know lots of therapists who truly believe, and here's the line, here it comes, with your intention alone, and they mean by you intending that it will work, they will be healed by your intention alone. And that makes me feel uncomfortable. Well, that's Elmer Gantry to me. That's That's God coming off the mountain, yeah?
Well, do you know what as well? I think that probably would open up another line of discussion altogether into creating a short-term placebo effect,
mm-hmm.
and creating change, which could fill up 2, 3, 4 discussions as it is. I'm actually keeping an eye on the time, Bob. I think what we should do is, when we speak to Lorraine in a little bit, I think it should be a thing going forward that we do canvas our guests into what they think about evidence-based, how they interpret what it is. But we'll use this as an opportunity as well to put it out there, as you said at the start of the show, put it out there to people who consider themselves on the side of evidence-based hypnotherapists.
Yeah, because it's such a thing right now. A lot of people are using this words more than ever before in the last 2 years. And I'll tell you what, Nick, as we go through, some people will hear this and they'll look it up before they come on, maybe, I don't know. But my guess would be that many people won't even understand the question. How about that? Mm-hmm. They'll be intelligent people, but they don't get this evidence-based therapist completely. I think a lot of people are mistaken with the difference of evidence-based and that word that I can't remember.
Anecdotal.
The other one, anecdotal, yeah.
And do you know what? Anecdotal is too probably vague a term anyway.
I hate it.
You can split that up into, or even evidence-based is, because you can consider 30 years of therapy as evidence. But we're talking about the scientific research behind the stuff that they're teaching, the stuff that they're using.
Yeah. And do you know who made up the term evidence-based? The evidence-based guys. Do you know who made up the term anecdotal? The evidence-based guys. You can bet your boots. Nobody said, I'll tell you what I am. I'm an anecdotal therapist. That never happened.
There we go. We found the window, Bob.
But we're running out of time, yeah?
Evidence-based anecdotalists.
Yeah. But because I'm there doing the right thing for the guys, evidence-based on Bob Burns. E-B-B-B. M-B. I love it. And I'm the only one.
For now.
Shall we go?
Let's go. So we're going to be talking to Lorraine Gleeson and just enjoy the interview now. And then we're going to be back after the interview where I'm going to put to Bob another question. And it's a cracker. It's a two-part question. I think we've had one of those already. It's a two-part question and we'll do that after the interview. But for now, let's just enjoy the interview. And on this week, we are very pleased to be welcoming Lorraine Gleeson. Lorraine has been a practicing hypnotherapist for 13 years now, and in 2011, she opened up the Hampshire School of Hypnotherapy. Lorraine has worked alongside and trained with some of the most respected names in the profession, including Wilf Proudfoot and Roy Hunter, and I believe Bob Burns as well. So I just extend a warm welcome to you, Lorraine. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And as you know, Bob and you are already friends.
We are, aren't we, Bob?
Absolutely. Lovely to have you, Lorraine. And when was it I saw you down there in Portsmouth? How long ago was that?
Oh, my goodness. It was certainly a few years ago. It was the early days of when you came up with the, is it the swan that you do?
Yeah. So it's maybe 6, 7 years.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
We met up
for a lovely lunch. And you did your magic tricks in the pub, and we had a whole circle of people around us.
And you became brilliant with the business card. Then you took it further. Remember?
I did.
Yep,
I did.
There you go. Yep.
And that was an amazing trick. And every time I met someone, I produced that trick because I also had it on the phone, didn't I?
That's right. You showed it to me later with the phone. That was lovely. So look at you now. The good news is that you do, you're a kind of a triple thing. You're a therapist. You also do your online training. We're going to talk about that later. And you've just started doing workshops, I believe. Is that through the National Hypnosis Society, yeah?
Well, basically, I've been running workshops for quite a while, and I think where I'm quietly just creeping along, I'm keeping my head down, I'm training, people are starting to invite me along to their training schools. So the National Hypnotherapy Society, I run CPD workshops for them. And then recently I had a phone call from a lady in Cambridgeshire, and I'm going up to Cambridgeshire on November the 18th on another location. So slowly I'm starting to be invited out more and more to produce the workshop.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So we've got a couple of questions we'd love to ask you. Nick, you'll jump in anytime you want with something, but can I ask one other one quickly right now? I noticed on your website it says that you do regression. Let me ask you, is that regression to cause, or do you actually do past life regression?
Well, basically, the way I do regression, it's different. You know how you love your swan?
Mm-hmm.
I have spent years and years developing the ID Moco response, and I train it very, very differently to other schools, and the way I've developed it, regression to cause, or I don't do analysis regression. I'm not a believer that you should go back and torture people on every single trauma that they've experienced to get to the initiating event. So the way I teach and the way I work is I facilitate an IMR, and what I would do, say for example you came to me and you said, you know, I want to work with anxiety, I would count through the ages of your life whilst you're in hypnosis, and I would ask the subconscious mind to indicate each event that's a contributor to this problem. So we go right back, and I get finger twitches until we go back to the youngest age, and then I say to the subconscious mind, do we need to visit the initiating event, or do we need to look at where the habit was learnt? So to me, to really and truly be 100% client-centered hypnotherapist, you should be facilitating the IMR, or whether you call it the IMR or not, Bob, it's still bypassing the conscious mind, because otherwise, what you're doing, in my opinion, is you are getting your client to fit your techniques. So, and a great example, and I can use the lady's genuine name because I worked with the Technopole in Portsmouth, and Sophie, who I've worked with on many occasions with certain things, she wanted to come to see me because she wanted to run a marathon. And she she said, the thing is, Wayne, there's a part of me that says I can't do it. There's a part of me that says I can. And she was showing the hands and showing me the parts. So what do you think most hypnotherapists would have done? What technique would they make fit that particular session?
No, there's so many.
But what I did, where I facilitate the IMR, I said to the subconscious mind, is it okay if I bring the part forward? And the subconscious mind said, no. Do we need to look at the cause? And we had to regress her back to when she was 16. And at the age of 16, she was taking her A-levels. And we dealt with that anxious feeling. And I'm afraid to say she ran 13 marathons in 13 months. I've told her she's a therapist. She's won too many marathons. So, and past life regression, I do facilitate past life regression, but I will only work with past life regression. If someone inquires and says, can I do a past life regression? I'm very funny with who I will facilitate it with, because I'm a great believer that past lives are past, whether you believe them or not, past lives are past lives. And if you've got a problem in this life, you need to deal with that first before you start visiting past lives. However, I don't know if you use regression, sometimes clients will accidentally regress to a past life, and that is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can guarantee you the people that regress to a past life regression accidentally are usually architects, doctors, consultants, and their first words when they come out of hypnosis will tell me that they thought that was the biggest load of rubbish they've ever heard. Mm-hmm. And I say, that's fine. It doesn't mean, it's not evidence of past life, but it's how you filed something. You may have read a book, you may have watched something on the TV, it doesn't matter. They're my favourite past lives.
Mm-hmm. I think it is evidence of past life. I'm okay with that. Because evidence is only evidence, it's not proof. Okay. So evidence is, that's it's evidence, but that's all that it is. So, I mean, somebody once said, there's no evidence. Well, it's never happened to anyone. Well, it has. It's happened to a couple million. Yeah, but it's only evidence of what might be.
Solicitors in the office next door to mine, and she's actually writing a autobiography on it. I did a past life with her, and she went back to a life in Portsmouth, where she was 28, and we had so much detail, where she lived, where she was buried, what she died from, 200-300 years ago. And she's found the grave. and she's found the death certificate, and she died. So she's actually writing her experience of her past life. How cool was that one?
Again, and it's lovely. And again, that will still be evidence, yeah? Yes. Even that won't even be proof. It's crazy, isn't it? Because there might be other reasons why that happened. But let me ask you this question. When you say you do idiomotor responses, on what? Is it finger movements?
Yes, but it's not complicated. I don't, because from my training, from Wilf and my other teacher, Roger, both of them, you know, I've been taught to believe that the subconscious mind is that of a bright 9-year-old child. So with me, it's a straight yes or a no. I don't have this don't know, don't want to answer that. Because to me, a bright 9-year-old child is a yes or no. Life is still black and white. Mm-hmm. So it's
but,
very
but, simple. But that's on the premise that it is a bright 9-year-old child.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's how I work with the subconscious as a bright. You know, I was training yesterday, and one of the delegates in the group, she's wanting to give up a full-time job, as so many people are, but frightened to because of the income. And because I love my job, I said to her, do you want to stay after class and we'll work with that? And on the idiomotor response, I actually said, do you understand so-and-so wants to be able to set up our own hypnotherapy practice? And it said no. And, you know, the thing, and so then I treat it like a bright, you know, I use closed questions, I treat it like a bright year-old child. We overcame it, and when she came up out of hypnosis, I said to her, I said, do you realise your subconscious said that you don't want to set up practice? And she said, well, that's not technically true. I am trained in, and she's got this amazing skill set. She's done Reiki, she's done the people that fiddle with their feet, what are they called? When they massage your feet.
Oh, reflexology.
That's it, reflexology. She's done lots of other things. And she said, I'm a bit undecided which one I want to do. So how accurate is that?
So let me ask you this question. Do you ever have the part within the subconscious telling you that it's other than a bright 9-year-old child?
Sorry, I didn't understand the accent.
Okay. Do you ever get the part through idiomotor response telling you that it's not that's not what it is, that it's something else? Does that ever happen? Do you ever go there?
No.
No. So you use finger idiomotor responses. Is there a reason why you use that as opposed to, let's say, a pendulum? Or is it the same, do you think?
I think the reason I use the IMR is because it is a movement that very often when a client's in hypnosis, and actually I experience it as well, you don't actually feel the finger come up and you have no idea that it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually bypassing the conscious analytical mind. And Bob, I have seen some of the most mind-blowing things created on the IMR. One of my clients, I actually watched physically. Now, if I read this in a book, I would doubt it. But when you see miracles happen in your therapy room, she cancelled her appointment. I've worked with her for, we were working on quite a lot of issues that she had. And her story's actually in. Am I allowed to do a plug here for Roy Hunter?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, go for it.
Her story.
I mean, he's 127, for God's sake.
He's
yeah.
Not 127. He's really? 125.
Give me a rubber, Lee, will you? Your rubber.
No, he's written this book with, I think it's called Inner, it's a spiritual hypnosis book. And this particular client was in there. And she had to cancel her appointment because she had a cold. And when she arrived 6 weeks later, her nose was still red and totally inflamed. And I actually said to her, is that the same cold? And she said, and under hypnosis on the IMR, I actually said, subconscious mind, you know exactly how to send all the healing. You know exactly to send all the right chemicals to let that cold go. And I got the yes response. Are you willing to do it for me now? And I didn't actually mean the red nose to disappear. I just meant the healing. But in front of my very eyes, in that instant, her nose went from bright red swollen to normal size. When I counted her up out of hypnosis, I actually asked her to go and look in the mirror because I thought I was going mad. And I did say to her, but I wish I'd filmed it. And she said she wished she had. So, you know, to me, every evidence that I've ever seen and worked with on the IMR using a finger, it's always a subconscious mind.
I've got a question on that. So you use a process called the Ages of Life when you're working with regression and clients. We also obviously incorporate ideomotor responses with that. Does that mean you can work with regression but keep it content free as well? So if you don't have to go down the psychoanalytical route, you can just go back to stages.
I wouldn't go to stages. That to me, that's analysis.
Right.
And I can work totally. Very often, I am content free. Mm-hmm. Hence why I can, you know, and I know this is going to open a can of worms. I can work with my family. You know, I very often work with my daughter. She does not say a word to me. She literally, everything's done on the IMR, including the regression, inner child, gestalt. Everything's done without her telling me anything. And I work with her. She would not work with anyone else. And I have this little code that I say. She's not going to listen to this cast, by the way, and she's out of the
room.
No
one does.
Good. And I say to her two questions. I say, Rachel, was it me? No, I ask her one question. She has two answers. Rachel, was it me? And there's two answers. She'll either say no, or I'm not telling you.
Do you know what's wonderful about that? No one can see, but we can see the three of us, and we all leant in there like we was discussing something totally secret.
I know. Well, it is secret. No, I'm not telling you. So that means it was me.
Right. Now, here's another question that I have as well. Regression, and this leads up to another question that I wanted to ask. Bob and I have been arguing about the merits or even the description of what evidence-based hypnosis is. Now, a lot of the evidence-based, and I'm doing air quotes now, evidence-based hypnotists will argue that there is no such thing as regression, for instance, because memories are reconsolidated, reconstructed rather, and no memory is the same. That there's no evidence to support regression. What is your view on evidence-based hypnosis or hypnotists?
Well, basically, I thought, what on earth is evidence-based? So I Googled it, and it's similar to what I thought it would be. It basically means it's clinical. There's trials done it. Now, to me, well, our job is not clinical. It is creative. So if you can have evidence based to say this is proof that this can be done, it would mean that, in my opinion, that if I came to see you, I came to see Bob, or even came to see me, it would be identical therapy produced. And to me, with evidence on a creative therapy, you're going to get different results depending on who the therapist is.
That's pretty good. I'm very happy with that. Nick?
Yeah. As a trainer, how much of your course, because your courses are accredited, right? So they have to do training to the National Occupational Standards and what have you. So how much of that do you pack with theory, or is it very practically based?
I'm a very practical trainer. And I'm a bit of a queen of manuals. So to actually get it accredited, there are certain things on the curriculum that I have to cover. Like, for example, the history of hypnosis. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been a hypnotherapist for 13 years, and I can be really honest with you. There is no client that has ever said to me, can you tell me the history of hypnosis? And if they did, I'd say, well, do you want me to pay me for a session or for a history? So the way I can actually, what I would do on my training, that's their home study. Find out the history of hypnosis. So, and then you have to teach a certain amount of techniques. And as long as you fit the criteria, it's fine. But I'm a very, the way I teach in the morning is theory, because to me it's a practical job. And we all, after lunch, it's all practice. What I get amazed at is when I go into other schools where people are trained, is how many trainers don't actually do practical. How many hypnotherapists have gone through an accredited training course and nobody's actually watched them hypnotise anybody?
Yeah. And again, that's a point that Bob has argued before, you know, going back to the evidence-based argument, that many of the trainers are too heavily weighted on the theoretical side of hypnosis and not the practical element. Right, Bob?
Absolutely. And even if they do, it's you know, it's not a real case. As you know, Nick, and you know also, Lorraine, I train a lot in my therapy room with real life clients. Mm-hmm. When a client comes in the door, the student's sitting there, they didn't expect, well, they knew there'd be somebody sitting watching, but the student has no idea who's coming through. They get to see me win, they get to see me fail. And back to what we were talking about earlier, Nick, no one would sitting watching me would think, oh, he's using evidence-based materials. We go straight forward to not the anecdotal, but the practical, just as Lorraine was saying. Can I move that into a different area, Lorraine? Is that okay? I want to ask you a question that's something that interests me. I noticed that you do smoking sessions. You do it in one session. You charge £150. Uh-huh. So this is not a trick question. I genuinely want to know, how did you get rung to 150 as opposed to 1,000, as opposed to 50 in one session, as opposed to 20? Where are we? How did you get there?
Because I don't like doing smokers.
Sorry?
Because I don't like doing smokers. It's the one
thing
I don't want
to
do.
That's a great answer.
And I know, because I'm cheap, people are going to think, well, why is she so cheap? But that's my reason. I don't like working with smokers. It's not... And I'll tell you why, because it's so hit and miss. And although it is, I put £150 for one session, bearing in mind my sessions aren't an hour, like mine are an hour and a half. I don't know how anyone does it in an hour. Mine's an hour and a half. And I always contact them 2 weeks later and check that they're still non-smokers. And then if they're not, then I will do another session for them free of charge. And I suppose the reason... I suppose it's just an area that I don't really enjoy working in. So that's why I'm so cheap. One of my hypnotherapists, she's double my price and she's really busy with smokers. And I do think the dearer you are, the more smokers you're going to work with.
Just move. And, let's move forward. We won't call you cheap anymore, Lorraine. We call you cost effective.
I do know I am very successful with smokers as well. But just don't let the general public know.
Are you a former smoker, can I ask?
Yes, I am. And yeah. Actually, no, I'm not a former smoker. I've given up. No, I haven't given up. I am going to start smoking again when I'm 70.
I actually thought about that.
Bob, you've got 8 months.
It seemed not a bad idea. Lorraine, let me ask you this question. If you're brave enough to answer it, do you have any idea at all what your success rate is with smokers?
Oh.
That they never smoke again? Any idea?
You know, ex-smoker, in all honesty, I know one of my hypnotherapists argued with me, I believe that once you're a smoker, you're always a smoker. And it's so easy to go back. You can go back to smoking like that. But clients will ask you, how successful are you with giving up smoking? And I try to be as honest as I possibly can. I said, the one thing I will guarantee, because part of my therapy is, when you come to me to give up smoking, you can't have had a cigarette for the last 2 hours. Because I use a technique, it's the kinesthetic swish, and we all have different names. It might be called collapsing anchors, but I use this technique where I turn the craving off instantly. So they walk in wanting a cigarette. Within minutes, they don't want one. And then, you know, I go through other processes and I use different techniques. And they walk out of the door not wanting a cigarette. I follow up 2 weeks later, and I used to think that I was an absolute failure because not many people reply to you. You send a text, hi, it's Lorraine, how are you getting on as a non-smoker? And over the years, because I've done the job so many years, I get referrals from people that I've worked with smoking, and then I say, but they never contact me back, and they say, oh, that's because we've stopped. So how successful is any hypnotherapist? I'm not a lover of how we make these claims now that we used to do it in one session. It's one of the few therapies I do think we can do in one session. But now there's a whole, let's do it in 3 sessions. Let's do it in 5 sessions. The fact that I'm going to take up smoking at 70, the fact is with smoking, you either smoke or you don't. There's no in between. So if you're walking in and you think, wow, I've got another 2 sessions before I have to actually give up, I do think it would lower your success rate. But that's my opinion.
And in the same vein as both Bob and I, for our listeners, there speaks the wisdom of an ex-smoker.
I'm going to smoke again.
A smoker who's taken a hiatus right. till their 70. Yeah, sorry. So, but that is, you know, that comes from a place of understanding smoking.
I wanted to ask a question to come back just to where we were before we slid into that. I wanted to ask this question to Lorraine. Lorraine, do you ever take your IMRs? Because you work a lot with IMRs. I hear your nickname is the Queen of IMRs down there. So let me ask you this. Do you ever take your IMRs to another level, or do you stay at yes, no? Can you get all your results with that?
I'm very, very good at closed questioning. So, okay.
And that's what yes, no's are?
Yes, they are. So basically, for example, if I wanted the subconscious mind to help with something, I would say to them, right, Bob's come here today. He wants to deal with this problem. Do you understand? Yes or no? Is there anything that we need to do? So using closed questions, you can actually frame everything that you can achieve.
Yeah, but for example, that question you just asked, there was an open question. Is there anything that we need to do? It's not a closed yes. question, is it? So how would you answer that?
Yeah, but it is closed. Is there anything we need to do? Because a closed question, the answer would be yes or no.
But it's part one of two questions. That's a yes or no. Following the next question, what is it that we need to do, yeah?
No, I'd have to... Do you know what it is that we need to do, yes or no?
Okay,
and
after that?
Then I would follow on with suggestions. Do you need Nick to understand what it needs to be done? And I could do it totally content-free on closed questions.
Are they in hypnosis at this time?
Yes.
Okay. If you ask the bright 9-year-old child within, let's say,
yeah.
to then tell you, would they tell you?
I don't tend, unless I'm facilitating parts therapy, I don't tend to get them talking.
Okay.
And parts therapy is absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, well, that's where I came from. That used to be what I did. I used to be a parts therapist. I have no arguments with that. Yeah. Nick.
In fact, I think there'd be very few practicing hypnotherapists, and the emphasis on the word practicing hypnotherapists, who won't be incorporating some elements of parts therapy and idiomotor, or they should be if they're not incorporating it. So check out Lorraine and the Hampshire School of Hypnotherapy if you want to actually develop your understanding of IMRs and parts therapy further. Now, I am going to have to be the stick in the mud and hurry stuff along. Bob mentioned at the start of the interview that you're branching out into online training. So if you could share and give us a little bit more information on what you'll be doing now.
Well, there's always a debate. Should you do online training? Shouldn't you do it? So I partnered with a friend of mine, Claire Butcher. She's got another training firm, not hypnotherapy. She's been a trainer for many, many years. And we went into a filming studio. Mm-hmm. And we spent a year filming all of my training. And we've just put it up online. And to me, there's always this debate. Should you train online? Shouldn't you train online? I think that's another thing to debate with. For me, I actually, now that I'm a practicing hypnotherapist, personally, I prefer to train online because I very often go along to a classroom and classrooms get very detracted. But the online training I do hate is if someone set a camera up in a room and they're just filming the training and then they put that up online for sale. So online training, I think, is brilliant for hypnotherapists that know what they're doing. Because let's be honest, all I have to do to learn a technique is I just watch it, and then I can do it. Mm-hmm.
So your online training will be filmed in a class, but then you're adding...
No, my online training has been filmed in a proper film. I'm faced to camera, as we're sat on Skype now.
Okay,
I'm
gotcha, yeah.
And we've got the film crew. We had so much fun. We had so many laughs. I'm not scripted, because one of the things they realised very, very quickly, do not give me cue cards, because then I've got this dead straight face. So there's face to camera, and then Claire, we have interviews where she asks questions, and then we have role play, so you actually watch therapy being facilitated, and the sound is right. It's not all this, you know, the microphone's being moved. We discovered that I grow chin hair, because if I scratch my chin, they feel the mouth. I know that. How awful is that? It sounded as though I needed to shave. Yes. So it's, you know, it's been a massive project, and I think it's brilliant.
So none of it is live. None of it is live. No, it's called online training, but it's not live.
What do you mean live?
It's not me. And like, this is live right now. This is online. Yeah. No. So some people do online training where they're chatting to people, and they're actually training online in a live situation.
Yeah.
Yours is basically video clips. Yeah. Online.
Yeah.
And will it be streamed or what?
There's this. I've got an amazing website guy. He discovered this program called Learn Dash. Mm-hmm. And so you purchase it, and then you have access to the videos for 30 days. And there's manuals to download, and so you can follow it on the manual. So it's basically means you can train at your own, you can watch it at your own leisure. You have all the manuals to print off.
And are these CPD courses, or in fact whole hypnotherapy training courses?
There is CPD, which will be growing,
cool.
But there's the certification in hypnotherapy. It's my whole diploma course. But of course, you cannot have a fully accredited diploma unless you have done classroom training. And one of the things I make very, very clear is you cannot. You know, I tend to think if you've just done online training, you should put it on your website. You should say, I've only trained online. And then it gives the general public the option to say, do I want to go and see a hypnotherapist that has never done any classroom training?
Yeah.
Would you want to?
Well, I wouldn't go. I wouldn't want to go and see anyone. I mean, I'm a monster. I wouldn't want to go and see anyone who hadn't trained in the therapy room.
Me neither.
So I don't want them to have done classroom training or online training. I want to know if they've trained in the therapy. Like a doctor. I'm a doctor. I did online training. Is that okay? No. I trained in the classroom. Is that okay? No. I want to know if you were in the surgery. But again, I'm a monster. That's just the way I am. And I was lucky enough to have trained in the therapy room. I had a mentor who took me into a therapy room. So I'm just not right. I'm just not right. That's the way it is. And there's lots of people who've trained in classrooms and are great therapists, so I need to shut up. And there'll be lots of them who have trained online and will be training online, and they'll be great. So again, I need to shut up. But I may be a dinosaur when it comes to this. It's just the way it is.
You sound like one of my teachers, Roger. He always told me he's a dinosaur.
Roger was wonderful.
He was very, you're like this, he was very, very anti-NLP. And
There's another topic.
I know, and I used to, my teacher, in one of my trainers in Dorset, that 10-foot tour, we used to have some of the most interesting arguments. I used to have to jump up to be able to be face on the same level as him. And he used to say to me, Lorraine, I am a dinosaur. You will not change me.
But it's the way that things are going. For example, right now I do a lot of work where I help and heal and fix people, as do thousands of other therapists, online in Skype sessions. If you told me that would have happened 15, 20 years ago, I would have walked up. I wouldn't have had a conversation with you. So, yeah, it's the new world. It's what's happening. We're okay with that.
Now the bearer of bad news is going to speak up again now. We are running out of time. I'll thank you, and then I'll pass it over to Bob to thank you. I know you've had Bob down before to teach the swan. Uh-huh. I know that Bob's itching to be invited back. He hasn't told me that, Lorraine, but he's...
It wasn't that. It's just she's had Roy now a couple times.
Yeah.
Bob, it's odd. Quite a few of my therapists keep asking me, are you going to have Bob Burns back?
Did they say that, Lorraine, or are you going to have Bob Burns back?
No. Well... I'll be honest, some of my, because my training's always clients, my training is students focused. None of my training courses are the same. There are occasions when I show you a little DVD in classroom.
We don't want to see Bob's DVDs.
I've seen his DVD. I saw the
end.
Yes, and it would be great to have you back in Portsmouth.
We'll do something there. We'll get that arranged, Lorraine. That would be fantastic.
There we go. Yeah. And you only have five for Bob.
They still do the fantastic buffets. The Admiral Drake, remember?
That was great. That was a fantastic day, yeah.
Right, so I'm going to, on behalf of myself, Lorraine, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put up links to your website where they can find out about your training, where they can find out about you as a practicing hypnotherapist, a little bit of your background, more about the Hampshire School of Hypnotherapy. So on behalf of myself, before I hand over to Bob, thanks ever so much. And speak soon. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great, Lorraine. Thanks ever so much. And this is where we say goodbye to you. And Nick and I talk about just how bad it was. Isn't that horrendous? We're monsters. You'll be listening to this later and thinking, these guys, what are they like?
So there we have the lovely Lorraine Gleeson. That was great, wasn't it, Bob?
Fantastic. I love Lorraine Gleeson. She's absolutely great. We had the chance to work together, as we said, about 6-7 years ago, and it was just a great day. And I tell you, Nick, everybody there, her students and what have you, they absolutely love this woman. They dote on her. She's just an absolutely great, great lass. And her and Pete down there, I had such a wonderful time with them. It really was absolutely fantastic.
And I don't know if people know, but after the interview, you really pitched an opportunity to go down there for a second time, didn't you?
I wouldn't say that, Nick. There's pitching.
Borderline begging.
Okay, I'll go with that. Borderline begging. BLB. Boom. Yeah. And she said, in all fairness, you know, she said maybe, so there's a good chance of that.
And you're a positive pessimist, Bob, so you're going to take that maybe pessimist and run with it.
Oh, yeah.
Now
I'll be having a coffee with her next week. I'm going down south to Southampton on Friday of week, so I'll be there.
Just
anyone in the
Southampton
area, give me a call.
Make sure you're back in time for the following Friday, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, the following Friday will be in London, Canary Wharf.
Exactly.
I'm there with the Jacquins.
I know, it's going to be amazing.
Freddie's okay about it, but Anthony's refusing to wear the sparkle bra with the dangly bits. What a boy that is. He'll spoil any day if he gets the chance, but we'll see what happens.
Let's just hope he's rehearsing the dance.
I love it.
It's a showstopper.
I love it. Bobby and the Jacquins. I absolutely love it.
They're calling it something different. Anyway, so we now have that wonderful part of the show where, Bob, you become the expert. You are the expert, should I say. And we put to you a question that someone has written in. This one came in by text. And for those who are joining the show for the first time and are unfamiliar with this part of the show, it is this, that we ask people via the Facebook group, via the website, via the newsletter that they can join on the website, to email in a question to put to Bob. And Bob's going to plough through his 60 or 70 years of experience as a therapist to give them the best answer to their question. But, Bob, before, as you know by now, before I ask you that question, I just want anyone thinking of asking a question to listen to this short message.
We don't know who you are. We don't know what you want. If you are looking for ransom, we can tell you now, Bob's Scottish. He won't pay. But what Bob does have are a very particular set of therapy skills. Skills he has acquired over many centuries. Skills that make him a nightmare for people like you. Now, if you send Bob a sensible question, that'll be the end of it. We will not look for you. We will not pursue you. We will try to answer it. But if you don't, we will look for you. We will find you. And we will kill you.
Liam Neeson, God, he knows a thing or two. But what is it with the Irish? He's so angry. Hey, we're not going to kill you. But we will find you.
We will search for you.
Whatever the warning is. I thought that was quite good, Nick. What about you, yeah?
So, anyway, moving on to the Ask Bob question. For those who don't know, this is the part of the show where, totally unrehearsed, totally unprompted, Bob gets asked a question by me on behalf of someone who's either emailed in through the newsletter, through the contact form on the website or on the Facebook group, and put a question to Bob. And Bob's going to tap into his vast, vast experience and give the answer to the best of his ability. And let me just add, right, Bob, you do not know what I'm about to ask you.
I don't have a clue, but also people there will know that because I am a professional mentalist, right now there's a question I think you're going to ask forming in my mind. I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to write it down. I'm going to hold it up to the screen after you ask the question. Is that fair?
That's fine. Yeah, okay. I'm looking forward to it. Just by the way, just about this question as well, I do have to obviously paraphrase something. Some people send in questions that are either very long or too vague. So I do apologise if I do read out your question, but it's paraphrased. So, for instance, Brian from Braintree last week, I reworded his word, his question. But this question, and let's just see, have you written it down, Bob? Are you ready?
Yes, I've written down the question I think you're going to ask.
Okay, I might disappoint you now because it's actually a two-part question.
Okay, right.
Why something else there?
Okay, I can't go there. I can't. I've just got the first part. On you go.
Right. So this is from Trevor in Trowbridge. This one, and this is. I think it's a fantastic question. The first part of the question is this: in your experience, what is that absolute no-no in a therapy session when working with a client? The absolute no-no. Oh, and there's going to be a number of no-nos. The absolute no-no. And before you answer, the second part of the question, which you clearly hadn't preempted, was, and what is the absolute must? So the opposite. What is the absolute must?
Okay. Well, here's what I thought the question would be. I'm fairly holding up for you so that you can see it. Can you read that?
That was, where's Brenda from next door? No,
that's what I thought you were going to ask. And which is amazing because we don't even have anyone called Brenda from next door.
Nor do I.
Okay, maybe the magic isn't happening today, but let's see what we can do. So that first question was, what's the, an absolute no-no, yeah? For the therapy session. Now, that one's easy for me. Right now, it's been like this for a couple of years now. This thing, the internet's wonderful. Facebook is phenomenal, but there's little things that just tweak me every so often, and it makes me get quite quite angry. It even happened with somebody I knew. I was standing next to them as they told somebody this, and it's when the therapist says that they're going to fix them in one session. I can't understand why they would do that. I don't get it. I mean, even Jesus didn't fix everybody in one session. Mm. You know, no good works can be done these days. Somewhere back in that Bible somewhere. But, you know, I just don't get it. Why would anybody say that? I as you know, Nick, I always do a minimum of two sessions. Mm-hmm. I would never do one session unless it's for fear of flying or something like that. They go up, they're fixed, that's it. They give me a call. But mainly, it's nearly always a minimum of a couple of sessions. And never mind, I'm not on about the numbers of sessions. We'll do that at a later date. Right now, we're talking about the promise to fix them in one session. I just don't understand that.
Yeah. You've actually just taken the words out of my mouth. I wanted to clarify that. I think what you were trying to say is it's everything in one session. I can fix you.
Yeah.
I will fix you.
It's just a complete, and that was the question, what is a no-no? And that's a complete and absolute no-no. I have no idea how a therapist could open the mouth and say such a thing. Now, I know they're going to get people, and I've done it myself, and so have you. We fix people in a session. Mm-hmm. But that's when you use the wording, hey, you never know. You even use a little bit of humor. Hey, I might even fix you in one session. Come on, grab a seat. Let's see what happens, shall we? That's okay. And that can maybe happen. And I'm pretty decent. I can do that. Everybody can. But that's an exception to the rule. And you'll never, ever, ever build therapy with exceptions to the rule. It doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I have to say as well, I think sometimes there's a correlation as well between, and I consider it an inverse correlation, the fact that these people who are promising fixing people in one session are also charging sometimes, and in some instances, a lot of money as well, because of that promise. So, but this is this really is a whole can of worms that I do want to explore at some point, but I don't think we do today. So, so there you go. So that's your absolute no-no. Promising person, you will be fixed in one session.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it.
And do you know what? Because like you said, you're not saying that it can't be done. You're not saying it isn't done. And you're not even saying it isn't done often. But it's that hard, cold, hard promise of I will fix you in one session. Or even, as we see sometimes, in a matter of minutes. Which, again, is probably another two or three episodes on its own. So the second part of the question then, Bob, what is an absolute must?
This is a lovely one, isn't it? Because there are so many musts, so, but out of time, we'll throw you one. As you know, and I hope people will understand when I say this, when I say I'm scripted, I don't have a script that I pick up and read, but I'm well-practiced, I'm well-rehearsed over the years. I practice, and of course I forget, and that's really important that I do that as well, but I hold the whole bag of bones inside my head, if you like. So the template is always there. But here's something that I use, but these words are never spoken. How about that, Nick? Mm-hmm. I never actually use the words, but they're always there. So I believe that over just thousands of people have just sat there and looked at me, and they use different wordings to say it, and sometimes they don't say it at all. But I think there's always three things going through their head when they sit down. It's a total stranger in an opening a consultation, and they want to know, but they never actually say the words, but I can hear them in my head kind of saying, you know, can I trust you? Do you know what you're talking about? Can you help me? And they're always there, but there's the word that I've never spoken. You know, can I trust you? Do you know what you're talking about? Can you help me? And I tell them without using the words, but through almost parables, if you like, anecdotes for sure. Look, you can trust me. I know exactly what I'm talking about, and I can help you. So for me, that is an absolute must, or no good deeds can be done this day. Again, Jesus, I'm quoting Jesus. I'm going mental with the Jesus.
That happens to a lot of people in a twilight of...
But that's it. I think that's it. So for me, just a small throwaway, as we're talking here today with that little question you asked, that's the thing for me. I want to let them know that they can trust me, that I know exactly what I'm talking about. I know my business well, and I can help them. When that happens, they relax, and we can get on with the business. Yeah,
putting them at ease.
Putting them at ease through rapport. But knowing what you're talking about before you open your mouth, it really helps. Yeah.
It's been a tough one, this ask, Bob, because I've kind of agreed with everything you've said this week, Bob.
Well, you think you're agreeing with everything I've said. I mean, people can't see this. I'm looking at your eyes. They've been wide open since the start. You've got saliva running down over your chin. You're in what we call stage 4 hypnosis. That's a stage 4 depth.
Wow.
I hope James Stripp is listening to this, because I taught him everything about depth. So you're in level 4 right now.
Wow. Is that the big one? Or
level 4 is not the big one.
Right,
that's
you
a
go.
Quarter. That's a quarter. There are 16 levels.
16.
Everybody knows that.
Wow.
Everybody knows it. Everybody talks about it.
You sounded like an evidence-based hypnotist there, Bob. Now, on that bombshell, we're going to have to draw things to a close.
Yep.
We have got a try-out thing, but we're going to leave that as a bit of a surprise. And for those listening, that's what professional people do and say when they haven't thoroughly prepared their try-out thing this week. I've said it, Bob. I can't lie.
Is it going to be on the thing, try-out, where they can press the thing and they're going to get a nice surprise?
They are going to get the surprise of their life.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there
I
we go.
Wait.
Now, I'm just going to ask you, Bob, I'm going to ask you to say goodbye. I'm going to say goodbye now. In your goodbye, you can choose whether we have the president of the greatest democracy in the world closing us this week, as we did last week, or whether we have Bob and a guitar.
Okay. Let's have Donald, because the guitar is 9 feet from me. It's a big place, this castle. and I'm all wired up. So Donald is going to say goodbye in just a minute, but can I thank all you guys for coming along, especially the gorgeous Lorraine Gleeson. Lorraine, we're going to have a coffee maybe sometime next week. We'll pop in by to Portsmouth and we'll get together there. Nick, as always, been a pleasure chatting to you. And guys, you do have a look at our try it out when you go in there. And yeah, hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week. All the best.
Hello, Bob. Hi, mate. Yeah. Yeah, it's 3:30 this spot this time. Yeah. What are you worried about? No. I don't think Anthony Jackwin. I don't even think he listens to it. He's not going to be bothered, Bob. No, that's fine. Okay. Have you had your milk? No. Well, have you a glass of milk? And I'll tell you what. I'll play your jingle if it will cheer you up, okay? Okay, mate. Good night.
They said you gotta get some people in to write a good jingle for you. But we said, screw you. They said you gotta get some guys who can write and make it alright. You know it'll be just fine. But we said, screw you, yeah.
Yeah, sing a little bit, Nick.
Screw you. Screw, 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 screw you.
Nick, that was absolutely perfect.
Thank you, Bob.